Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, and welcome to the interview series, New Books in African American Studies, where writers and scholars of African American art, life, culture, and sciences discuss their new books. I'm your host, Vershawn Young, and today I had the opportunity to speak with Pierre W. Orlis about his provocative and fascinating new book, The Agony of Masculinity, Race, Gender, and Education in the Age of New Racism and Patriarchy. Orlis's book examines the personal narratives of 50 men of African descent and their relationship to patriarchy, maleness, sexism, racism, and homophobia. What you'll find in this book and in my discussion with Pierre Orlis is something that we all can learn from. Let's listen in. Hi, Pierre.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Thanks for asking. Today, we're speaking with Pierre W. Orlis, author of The Agony of Masculinity, Race, Gender, and Education in the Age of the New Racism and Patriarchy, published by Peter Lang in 2010. If the title tells readers anything, it alerts us to the psycho-emotional trauma that Black men experience, perhaps across the globe. It further suggests that trying to meet the expectations of masculinity breed rather than reduce the debilitating effects of heteronormativity and compulsory heterosexuality. Orlis brings a unique perspective to the ongoing analysis of gender in our era of the new racism. Like sociologist Patricia Hill Collins, who says the new racism must be understood in gender-specific ways, Orlis posits Black masculinity as the lens through which we can examine racism, sexism, and homophobia. I'm delighted to have Pierre with us to discuss his book. Pierre, will you begin by telling us a bit about yourself?
Sure, I'll be happy to. First, let me thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about my book and, of course, a little bit about myself. I was born in a poor working class family in Haiti. Haiti, as you know, was colonized by France, and we gained our independence in 1804 thanks to the sacrifice of the slaves who were imported from Africa to Haiti. I lived in Haiti up until I was like early 20s. I then moved to the United States. Now let me back up a little bit. When I was in Haiti, I was what would one call political activists. I remember when I was in high school, I led a movement that overthrew the high school principal, who used to call us communists, but because we used to have meetings where we invited people from the left to talk about issues, social justice issues, which the high school principal did not take well. Anyway, I finished high school in Haiti, and I spent about 3 semesters in college. And then I then moved to the United States, partly because my older brother was already living here, encouraged me to come here, assuring me that I would make it. In other words, I would be able to have a good education, a good job. So that's the mentality that many immigrants have. In fact, even people want to move to the United States or Europe, always think that if they come here, they will have a better opportunity, which is the case for many, but not all. In any case, when I first came to the U.S., it was at first challenging, both culturally and linguistically. By that, I mean I did not speak English, therefore I had to learn it. Once I felt that I had enough proficiency in the language, I decided to go back to school to finish my bachelor's.
Mm-hmm.
I did my bachelor's in human services, and I also did a minor in advocacy, human advocacy, thinking that I would go to law school, which in fact I tried, but I realized that law school was not for me. Therefore, I decided to go back to school to earn a master's degree in applied linguistics. Now, before I went back to school to earn my master's in applied linguistics, I worked as a social worker. Mainly, I served elderly folks who needed services to be to live well at home. I did that for about 3 years. Then I decided to go back to school to do a master's in applied linguistics. While I was doing my master's, I had the opportunity to teach at a high school located in the most marginalized neighborhood in Boston, Massachusetts. I taught reading, writing, and critical thinking skills to people of color, but mainly immigrants from Africa and the Caribbean. I did that for about 3 years. Then I got laid off in 2003. So I decided to go back to school again, once more, to pursue a doctorate in education. While I was doing my doctorate, I had the privilege to work with urban school teachers, which was a very positive experience for me because I was able to apply some of the theories, knowledge that I acquired in the classroom. So that was a good opportunity for me to see, to be able to put in practice what I was learning in my classrooms, in my classes. So when I finished my doctorate, as like everybody does, you know, you go on the job market looking for a job. So I did that, and I was made two offers, one of which was at New Mexico City University, which is the place where I'm currently teaching and doing research. More or less, that's been my trajectory. I don't know if you want me to expand on certain, you know, areas of my life experience from Haiti to the United States, but basically, in a nutshell, that's been my journey.
And perhaps later in the discussion, some of that might become relevant to discuss as we discuss some of the interviews that you talk about in the book. But before we begin to discuss, in particular, the agony of masculinity, can you tell us a little bit about your first book, Under Occupation, The Heavy Price of Living in a Neo-Colonized and Globalized World?
Well, that book, as you may know, I wrote it when I was a student. As I mentioned earlier, Haiti was colonized by France. So in the Haitian school system, we essentially learn things about France, the history of France, French philosophers, learn about them, French literature, and there wasn't enough emphasis when I was going to school in Haiti, there wasn't enough emphasis on Haitian literature, Haitian culture. It seems to me the teachers had a colonized mind. They wanted us to learn about French literature, French history, whereas Haitian history, Haitian literature was not something that they really emphasized on. So I found that very problematic, and I resisted this form of colonial legacy. Then moving from Haiti to the United States, I was faced with linguicism, you know, discrimination based on one's language, on one's native language. So all these experiences combined, I realized that it was important for me to put it into print, like my voice, it was important for me to put my voice into print. This is why I decided to write that book while I was pursuing my doctorate in education. Basically, in the book, I provide a critique of the Haitian school system, which is still a colonial based school system. In other words, all the books that I used when I was in high school reflect deeply French literature, French culture, French literature. Even the on the cover of those books, you have images, pictures of French philosophers, French writers, But there, like I said, there wasn't enough emphasis on French, on Haitian literature, Haitian history. Although there were some teachers, my high school history teacher was very conscious of that, and he made the effort to talk about Haitian history in the most inspiring, profound way. Nonetheless, there were teachers, like I said, who had a colonized mind. They thought that French, the language, is superior to, you know, Haitian Creole. And I resisted that in high school. And when I came to the United States, I faced similar challenges, you know. English is perceived and treated as a dominant language, whereas other languages are looked down upon. Mm-hmm. And I faced that as a college student. I faced that as a high school teacher. And I thought it was important for me to talk about those issues. Issues such as, you know, bilingual education, the English only movement. I try to challenge that in my work. And I also look at, you know, how culture influences how people think, you know, how people behave, how people perceive others and treat others. So more or less, that's what I try to address in that book.
And so tell us how you came to write The Agony of Masculinity.
That's a very good question. Well, as you may know, Haiti is a very male-dominated country. There's a lot of male dominance in Haiti, a lot of sexism, homophobia. And I was exposed to it early on in life. My dad, who I highly admire, was a sexist man. I mean, the way he treated my mom, my sisters, was not human in many ways. He had low expectations of my sisters, whereas he thought that I would always be successful because I was a man. He always expected my mom to cook clean for him, while he would not treat her right. So, it doesn't matter how tired my mom was. When she came home, she had to clean for my dad. She had to, you know, make sure the house was well kept, you know, was clean. And that was that's what was expected of my mom. Even though she was a hard worker. She worked long hours, but when she came home, she still had to make sure there was food on the table. Otherwise, my dad would be mad. So these are the things I experienced growing up as a boy. When my dad learned that I had like 2-3 girlfriends, and I would be praised for that, you know. And instead of saying, Pierre, you should be careful and you should treat the women right, you should not, you know, you shouldn't be having 4 or 5 girlfriends while your girlfriend, you know, are not allowed to have 2 or 3 boyfriends. So, you know, I had that male privilege that I did not question as a boy. I thought it was the normal thing to do, having 3-4 girlfriends and brag about them. And my dad, my older brother, and close friends, close male friends would praise me for it. And then when I came to the United States, I continue witnessing male dominance, but also racism. So I think, you know, I thought it was important for me to sort of combine those two, blackness and maleness, and explore them in a book. So while I was pursuing an advanced graduate certificate in women's studies, I took many classes which really shaped the way I see, understand maleness, masculinity, and in relation to racism and white supremacy and patriarchy. And so, as I was sitting with my wife in the living room, I clearly remember it was a Thursday evening. We were just talking, and I said to her that, you know what, I would like to write a book on black masculinity. And of course, as always, she said to me, yes, honey, you should go for it. Well, the same night, I started making a list of men that I thought would be interested in participating in the book. So I contacted, you know, friends, classmates, professors, and neighbors. And so I emailed them, and I emailed about 70 men that I knew. And of course, I talked to some of my friends to invite their friends to participate in the book. And about 50 responded positively to my request. They are from, you know, they were from different diverse backgrounds in terms of race, class, gender, and ethnicity. Some of them were university professors, while others were, you know, college dropouts, taxi drivers, street performers, you know, guidance counselors. People who were arrested in jail for drug trafficking and Some of them were owned street clubs, and I wanted to make sure that my participants, you know, has a different, you know, diverse background and would bring different voices share different insights with me about black masculinity. So more or less that's how the idea of the book was created, was conceptualized, if you will. That's about it.
And the interviewees in the book, as you say, spanned the gamut of genders and sexual identities, as well as ethnic background under the rubric of black. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Could you rephrase what you said? I'm not sure if I understand your question.
In other words, the interviewees are not all African American heterosexuals. They are men of African descent, but some of them are immigrants. Some of them come from the Caribbean, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if you could tell us about the range of identities that your interviewees hold.
Okay. Well, you know, personally, I'm against ethnocentrism. And I thought it would be important for me to interview people from different backgrounds. And at first, the goal was to interview only African Americans. Then I said to myself, no, well, African Americans may not know how it's like to be a man growing up in the Caribbean, and having to face with, you know, patriarchy, sexism, and so on and so forth. So I decided that I would interview men of African descent. It doesn't matter where they are from. And so I have people who are, you know, who are African Americans, who are from the Caribbean, who from Africa, who came here when they were, you know, 7, 8 years old. They practically grew up here. So my goal was to interview people who have different experiences with racism, sexism, patriarchy. If I were to interview only African Americans, although African Americans are not homogeneous because there are class and sex, you know, class issues involved, but I thought it would be limited. Therefore, I said it would make more sense to interview people from Africa, because Africans, people who are from Africa may not have the same experience as African Americans. Likewise, people from the Caribbean, male of African descent who were born and grew up in the Caribbean may not have the same understanding of racism as African Americans, because they haven't been here living, they haven't lived in the United States long enough to understand the intricacies of racism. You see, so I thought it would be important for me to bring all different voices into the book so that the reader can have a more or less a comprehensive understanding of how race, gender plays out in terms of how men of African descent are perceived and treated in the U.S. society and beyond.
Can you tell us a little bit about the similarities and differences that you discovered among these men that you interviewed in terms of their experience with racism and patriarchy?
Right. One thing that I would – later on, I'm going to share with you some of the findings of the book, and I would illustrate further what you just asked me. But for now, let me say that men from, again, I'm generalizing because I'm only referring to those that I interviewed. Of course, the men from the Caribbean that I interviewed do not represent the voices of all men of the Caribbean. So I want to make sure that I point this out. Likewise, the African American men I interviewed in this book, their voices do not represent the voice of all African American men, right? So I would say this: based on the findings, it seems to me that men from the Caribbean seem to have a different experience with maleness and patriarchy. Although there are a lot of similarities, they all agree. Most of the participants agree that men have benefited from the patriarchal system that privileges the voices of men over women. That enables men to, for example, to be walking on the street without having to worry about being raped. So they understand that. They understand that men tend to be taken more seriously than women. That's a common thread that I found among the men of condition that I interviewed for the book. Similarly, they all shared with me that they have been victimized by the racist system in which they are operating as men of African descent. So, with the exception of one man of African descent who was born and grew up in Trinidad and Tobago, who stated that he has not experienced racism, partly because he spent most of his time in the lab doing experiments. He was finishing PhD in polymer chemistry. He was the only one among all the men, all the participants that I interviewed, who stated that he did not experience, or at least hadn't experienced yet, racism.
Mm-hmm.
All the men who participated in the study stated clearly that they have been victims of racism just because of their skin tone. And I don't know if that answers your question.
Are the men that you're referring to, all of the men, the ones who have a immigrant background as well as ones who are Native Americans or Native African Americans?
I did not interview Native. I don't know what you mean by Native African American, but I interviewed African Americans. Most of the participants that I interviewed actually were African Americans. There were some from the Caribbean, some from Africa, I mean from the continent, Africa, who came here when they were 18 years old. They came here for college. And I also interviewed a man who's from Algeria, different parts from Africa. And so these are the men that I interviewed, African Americans, Africans, and Caribbean men.
Okay.
And that was the man that I interviewed.
Yes, and that's very clear. And the question that I was asking, I just wanted to underscore what I heard you say, which is that despite the native background, whether they were born in the Caribbean and came to America, or born in Africa and came to America, despite the native background, all of the men except one said that they experienced racism by the sheer fact of their skin tone.
That's correct.
Is there any variation in terms of their experience with sexism or homophobia or et cetera?
Yes. I think there are more similarities than differences when it comes to homophobia. For example, one of the Haitian men I interviewed was born in Haiti. I believe he came here when he was about 12 years old. He has similar understanding about homophobia as an African American man whose father was African American and mother was Colombian. So, depending on the level of consciousness, I found some of my participants were more sophisticated, were more knowledgeable about the way the patriarchal system operates. Whereas some of them seem to be naive. And as it turned out, the participants were more interested in talking about racism than sexism, partly because they did not want to confront their own male privileges. And I've seen a lot of that. When I would begin the conversation talking about, you know, maleness, you know, and they would sort of deviate from that conversation and focus on racism, because that's what seemed to be they were mostly preoccupied by. So if you were to read the book, you would see that even though I wanted to get some insight from them about maleness, about their male privileges, many of them sort of deviated from my question, and they would rather talk about racism, which seemed to be the main concern. Nonetheless, those who did take the time to talk about patriarchy, sexism, they were pretty open about the male privileges. They also referred to the mothers, to their sisters, who they witnessed experiences experiencing sexism, and they were pretty open about it. Like I said, some of them sort of, they would just talk a little bit about it and move on to talk about racism.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Some of the men in the survey questions that you asked them did not openly disclose their sexual identities. Some of them did.
Right, that's correct. And I did tell them that when I was doing the interview, I said, you don't have to talk about your sexual preferences if you don't feel comfortable doing so. I give them the option, with the exception of one man who was clear. I mean, he was clear. He's a transgender man. He was born female, and later on in life, he decided to transition from being female to being male. He was pretty open about his sexuality. But most of the men did not want to reveal their sexual preferences, and I did not want to stigmatize them. I didn't want to have put them in a position where they had to see something that they didn't want to say. So I told them right from the beginning, I would like to know how you identify yourself sexually, whether you are bisexual or gay or straight. And those who seem to be straight, they would say I'm straight. Others were sort of different. They were sort of unclear. They were not. They didn't seem to be interested in talking about their sexual preferences. Like I said, they would talk about their male privileges and go and talk about racism. But it seems to me the question about sexual preferences was a little bit uncomfortable for some of them.
Why do you think that is?
Well, partly because of the stigma they have about gay, bisexual men, especially bisexual men of African descent. Perhaps they don't want to reveal that. And as you know, there are many men of African descent who are still in the closet because they don't want to come out. They don't want to come out and be stigmatized by their own community of color. And in fact, some of the men talk about that. They see that in the African American community, there's a lot of homophobia. To a point where men who are gay or bisexual, they don't wanna reveal that to their friends and families, because they know if they do that, they will be isolated, they will be stigmatized, they will be discriminated against. And I suspect that may have been the reason why some of my participants chose not to talk about to reveal their sexual preferences.
So is it fair to assume that among the interviewers, that the men who were unequivocally heterosexual or straight felt no discomfort in disclosing their sexual identity, but the men who may have been bisexual or homosexual did feel discomfort? Is that a fair assumption?
That's correct. That's correct.
Is it possible that there were some men who who were unequivocally heterosexual, but felt that disclosing that heterosexual identity may in and of itself be perpetuating heteronormativity. In other words, that by asserting their heterosexual identity, they would in some way be participating in patriarchy.
That could have been... That is a possibility, but based on my observation and my interaction with them, I didn't feel that some of them refused to assert their heterosexual, privileges because of the reason that you just evoked. But I agree with you. There are many men who refuse to say that they are straight because they want to challenge the patriarchal system that expect men to be straight, preferably, able-bodied, Christian, straight, white men. So, although I agree with you, what you said, and I'm fully aware of that factor, however, in my finding, I did not, discover any men. I didn't have any participant who chose not to talk about their heterosexual privileges, or just because of that reason. I think they simply did not. I suspect those who decided not to talk about that could have been bisexual. and refuse to reveal it. That would be my hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I don't have any evidence to support that.
Although there are, of course, men who disclose their sexual identities across the range as bisexual or homosexual and a straight among the interviewees. I just want to make that clear for the readers.
That's correct.
What was some of the surprises? Was there anything surprising about what you found in these interviews?
Yes, there was one instance. I interviewed a man who was born and grew up in Puerto Rico. He identified himself as Afro-Puerto Rican. And he shared with me that in Puerto Rico, it's okay to be gay if you are a white Puerto Rican, or the way whiteness is being constructed in Puerto Rico, it's okay. But if you are an Afro-Puerto Rican, it's a stigma. So it's harder for Afro-Puerto Ricans to reveal their sexual preferences, you know, if they are gay or bisexual, it's harder for them to come out of the closet than it is for Puerto Ricans who are identified as white. I thought that was interesting. I wasn't fully surprised by it, but I thought it was interesting, you know, and that is happening in Puerto Rico.
Mm.
So you see how race and sexuality and gender sort of play out, right? Are intersected, right? And that was a very interesting discovery in my research. I did not expect him to share that with me, partly because I don't know if he's bisexual. He never revealed his sexuality to me. He talked mostly about, you know, how he's been discriminated against in the U.S. by virtue of being Afro-Puerto Rican. And even went on to say that he's been discriminated against by his own people. And unfortunately, I did not get him to expand on that. But essentially what he said, he's been mostly supported by white Americans than people from his own native land. But what I found interesting in his statement was that Afro-Puerto Ricans in Puerto Rico tend to have a harder time coming out of the closet than Puerto Rican men who are identified as white.
So after reading the book and coming across that example, as well as some others among the interviews, I came up with an hypothesis that I'd like for you to respond to.
Sure.
It seemed as if whiteness pervasively defines a standard of masculinity. And that if you, to be non-white is already a position in which one's masculinity is questioned. And so to, identify with a non-normative masculinity or with a sexual identity that is other than heterosexual seems to support or justify a stigmatized or oppressed identity that's other than white. And so a Afro-Puerto Rican or even an African-American, for instance, may have this difficulty with their own gender identity because of the oppressed state that they're in.
I absolutely agree with you. And if we were to go back to historically, privileged white men have been doing defining how other men should behave, should perform their manliness. And even during the colonial era of slavery, men of African descent were somewhat stripped of their masculinity. The white man, the white master, were the ones who defined how they should behave. They could not openly perform the malice, except at home. In fact, I would go on arguing that in the sugarcane or in the plantation, they were not allowed to really perform their malice the way they would perform it at home. So what happened during slavery, there were the male slaves were oppressed by the white masters, ended up abusing their wives and children because of the oppression that they were experiencing in the plantation field and the sugarcane or cotton field. So anyway, they were somewhat, you know, stripped of their masculinity. And that legacy continues up until now. Privileged white males are the ones who define, you know, how one should behave as a man. So I'm not surprised that, Puerto Ricans or people of African descent, are conditioned to perform the manliness based on the standard that's been set by the white man. And when I say white man, I'm referring to privileged white men, because we know class, also shapes or informs how the man behaves. So I'm not referring to poor white men. I'm referring to privileged white men. So this is a model. Many men of African descent have been somehow forced to adopt, to emulate. And if you look at all the major Hollywood movies, what type of masculinity that's being displayed in these movies? It's a white, middle class form of masculinity. You see, it's very pervasive. It's very pervasive. And by being exposed to this type of misrepresentation of male performance by African American, by men of African descent, we have learned that to be accepted as a man, we have to perform the type of masculinity that's been set for us by privileged white males. So I'm not really surprised at all that we, as men of African descent, have the tendency to perform a type of masculinity that reflects a white way, if I can put it that way, of behaving, a white male way of behaving, of acting, of even speaking, for that matter. So it's not surprising at all to me as a researcher. But doing the research confirmed some of what I've believed even before I did the research. Mm-hmm. And of course there were surprises, and it did not occur to me that Afro Puerto Ricans are being oppressed. I'm referring to those who are gay or bisexual are being oppressed because they cannot come out, because a black man cannot be gay, a black man cannot be bisexual. That's taboo. But a white man can be. So it's a colonial legacy that we are still being a victim of.
Mm-hmm. Can you read to us some of a passage from the book?
Sure, I'll be happy to. The story of the 50 men involved. Again, I'm just going to read some of the narratives, some of the quotes, and then I will make a concluding remark if you don't mind. The story of the 50 men involved in my study illuminates how they have been taught to perform the malice, often in oppressive and destructive ways against women, other men, and themselves. Directly or indirectly, the performance of the maleness has not only been oppressive to women and men, but also contributed to maintain the patriarchal system. As a case in point, a 30-year-old man of African descent who claimed to be highly educated repeatedly said that women are soft and weaker than men, and that they should obey their husband, stay at home and take care of the children, clean the house and cook. A significant number of men who took part in the study shared this view. Another equally important fact that is worth noting here is that the story of nearly 99% of the participants reflect the high degree to which many of them have faced and endured the harmful effects of racism and white supremacy. Many of them lamented the fact that they have been discriminated against because of their racial and ethnic backgrounds. Likewise, they talk about the experience with maleness. For example, one of the men who was 60 years old, is African American, and he was a guidance counselor for over 20 years, burst into tears while he was talking about his mother. He also lamented the fact that he did not have an emotional connection with his father until his father died. He stated, and I quote, "My dad was a hard worker. I witnessed how angry he got when he was talking about his job. But he did not allow me to know him as my dad. He was just behaving like a man when I tried to approach him and talk to him. I wish I got to know him. I know he was a good man, but he never showed his emotions in front of us. The only time we got to see some of his emotions was when he came home and started talking about his white boss, who did not treat him right." End of quote. Similarly, Joseph, which is a pseudonym, a 27-year-old man who was born in Haiti but grew up in the United States, expressed disappointment about his authoritarian Haitian father, who spent more time disciplining his children than building a good relationship with them. He stated that at work, his father earned the reputation of being a friendly, warm, and funny person. However, at home, he was a very different person. Emotionally, he was completely detached from him, his brothers, and his sisters. He did not feel personally connected to his father until his parents were divorced. Joseph told his stories in the following terms, and I quote, "My dad was a very violent guy. In his mind, what he had to do to be a good father is to be disciplinarian by hitting us and by being mean and tough, so on and so forth. So I experienced him as very distant and disconnected from me, my mother, my brothers, and sisters," end quote. Similar to Joseph, Tom, whose African-American father died when he was 5 years old, complained that he did not feel that his white Colombian mother understood the racial prejudice and racism that he faced while he was a high school student. He therefore had to rely on his older cousin for support and counseling. However, his experience with his cousin was not pleasant. Often, his cousin forced him to get into fight so he could prove his maleness. The message that he constantly received from his older cousin was that, as a boy, he had to be tough and cannot be a punk or a sissy. Tom expressed his frustration in these terms, and I quote, "My Colombian mother was brought to the States, so she had a set of understanding of how race plays out in the U.S. system, but she did not really understand the intricacies of racism. So there were times when I came home and I explained to her that at school, there were teachers that did not expect much of me. Even though I explained that to her, she never fully understood what was going on. My cousin would tell me what I needed to do was to man up. He was sort of my immediate role model. He was about 5 years older than me, so he was the one that said, and I quote, 'This is what you need to do, man up,' end of the quote." Like Tom and Joseph, another African-American man in his mid-20s at the time, felt that he was expected to be tough and behave like a real boy, that is, repress his emotions. He was expected to show interest in sports so he would not be called a sissy. He had to resist and fight against the homophobic view of his grandmother, who questioned his sexual orientation because, in her view, friends did not show enough interest in girls as a boy. Friends said that he could not cry in front of his parents and grandparents who expected him not to show any emotion. His male friend, on the other hand, did not have any problem with him crying in front of her. That female friend was the only one among many who did not have a problem with men crying in front of her, in front of women. Friend narrates his story in the following terms, and I quote, "In high school, there was this image that the ideal man should be a tough guy or a thug. That wasn't me at all, but I noticed that a good portion of the women seemed to be attracted to that. So I felt compelled at times to be seen as tough in front of girls. Taking back to the first time I cried in front of a girl I liked, I have to say I appreciate her for supporting me and not reverting to the stereotypes of boys don't cry. Since that point, I no longer have the anxiety of crying in front of women who I have intimate relationship with. Although when I do it, it seems to make some of them react in surprising ways because they haven't seen that much in their lives. So most of the participants felt that they had to perform a certain type of manliness in order to meet the expectation of their friends, family members, and people in their community. Some argue that because they are black, people expect more of a male performance of them. I referred earlier to the African, to the Afro-Puerto Rican, who shared with me that it's okay for a white Puerto Rican to come out and say, you know, he's gay or bisexual, but for an Afro, for Puerto Rican, is much harder. And I also noted earlier that although most of the participants stated that they experienced racism, but there was only one man from Trinidad and Tobago who claimed that he hasn't yet been a victim of racism. This black male from Trinidad and Tobago stated, and I quote, I haven't had so much experience with racism, which I think is good, but I know I have friends who have experienced it. Maybe I'm being naive. I want my friends to try to get past racism so we can move forward as a race. Racism is not affecting me directly. I think I'm being a little bit naive or being open-minded. I think it would be more of a concern for me if I had experienced it directly, but I haven't. Alfred was finishing a PhD in polymer chemistry when I interviewed him for the book. In his own words, studying this type of chemistry is an advantage for him, as there are many people of color who study polymer chemistry. He said that as a student, he spent most of his time in the lab doing experiments. Consequently, he had very limited exposure to the outside world. Alfred felt that this might have protected him from being discriminated against as a man of color, as he has interacted only with a very limited number of people. When I asked him about institutional racism, he said that it actually works in his favor, as many companies are looking for people of color with a background in polymer chemistry. Alfred said, and I quote, "Actually, institutional racism works in my favor, being a black chemist, specializing in polymer chemistry. Some of these companies are actually looking to hire black polymer chemists because we are in demand. So it actually worked in my favor, although I would rather be hired on the basis of my skill and my experience, not because I'm a black chemist. Again, personally, I haven't experienced racism. Thankfully, I haven't been exposed to it, but that doesn't mean in the future I would not be. If that happens in the future, I'll try to remain open-minded and try to look at the situation objectively. Racism externally helps me, but it shouldn't, but it does. Individually, I haven't had too much experience with racism." End of the quote. So these are the quotes that I figured I would share with you, although there are many, 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 many more, but I figured I would end there.
That's excellent. Thank you so much. Can you tell us what you're working on now?
Right now, I'm working on many projects, one of which is a book called Linguistic Apartheid in the English Only Movement. And in this book, I'm looking at how from the colonial era until now, how Western countries have tried to silence other languages in other cultures to give primacy to dominant languages such as English, French, and obviously those two, French and English. And we have continued to witness the colonial legacy, as mentioned earlier. During slavery, many languages, many dialects, if you want to put it that way, were wiped out because the colonizers wanted to impose their own languages, their own cultures on the colonized. And with the English-only movement in the United States, we have continued to witness a new form of colonization as far as language linguistic and cultural issues are concerned. And that's what I'm trying to do in this book. I'm trying to make a point saying that the fact that we are living in the so-called post-colonial era doesn't mean issues that colonized people faced during colonization are gone. We are still facing cultural, linguistic, you know, oppression by those who are in power. And that's one project. The other project, I'm doing a book on Edward Said. I'm looking at how the legacy of Edward Said has continued to influence the work of many young scholars like myself. I think Edward Said's work is relevant and it always will be as long as we have U.S. imperialism, as long as we have Islamophobia, as long as the rest, by the rest, I'm referring to third world countries, are being looked down upon by the West. So Edward Said's work, like French Fanon's work, will always be relevant. So those are the two projects among many that I'm working on.
Thank you so much, Pierre, for joining us on New Books in African American Studies.
You're welcome, sir.
We've been talking to Pierre W. Orlis, the author of The Agony of Masculinity, Race, Gender, and Education in the Age of New Racism and Patriarchy, published by Peter Lang Press in 2010. I hope you enjoyed our discussion, and I hope you will return and listen to others on New Books in African American Studies.